Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. On this episode, we'll hear stories about our complicated love for Appalachia. In West Virginia, folks in a small town are sending love letters to strangers.
It gave us all hope, I think. You know, hope that we aren't just these isolated little communities struggling.
And a woman pins her love for a Kentucky racehorse.
Everyone said you ran like a champion, but I actually could not bring myself to watch that race until I sat down to write this letter. Even 2.5 months later, knowing the outcome, it still made me cry.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today, we're talking about love. But wait, it's not what you think. This episode is kind of one big love letter to Appalachia. We're showing off some of that Appalachian pride by talking about our complicated love for this place. Things like the whimsical, the quirky, the beautiful, the strong, the unexpected kindness of people reaching out to each other. Valentine's Day is not a favorite holiday for all people, especially people who aren't in a romantic relationship. But what about a bundle of unexpected letters written by strangers from a little town far away? Well, a town in West Virginia is about to receive about 700 love letters. Roxy Todd reports that these letters express well wishes, even for those who claim to be left out of Valentine's Day.
Last year, folks in Thomas, West Virginia, handwrote hundreds of letters to send to another small town that was chosen basically at random. The idea was to remind people that someone out there, someone that they never even met, really and genuinely cares. Gail Snyder lives in Madrid, New Mexico. Last winter, she was one of the people who received one of those love letters.
It was this total surprise, and everyone had their own private experience of going to their mailbox and finding this mysterious thing in the mailbox. It was addressed to fellow human being. It was like we got this special blessing or something from these strangers that none of us knew.
These whimsical letters were part of a community art project organized by Art Spring. Audrey Stephenson is an AmeriCorps volunteer who helped organize the project.
Well, I thought it was an amazing idea right off the bat. I thought that just what a sweet thing to do.
Seth Pitt first had the idea. He's an artist who co-owns the White Room Art Gallery in Thomas.
This was a thing that I used to do. I used to write letters to strangers, and I thought maybe it would even be a little bit more impactful if everyone was sitting around in a room together, all trying to send out goodwill to their fellow humans on this earth. I do think that a large part of this project, its goal is to make people not feel so isolated from one another.
People who live in the towns of Madrid and Thomas learned that they do share some similarities. They're both former coal mining towns, which have had to find other ways to survive when the coal mines in their town shut down. One town in the desert and another in the Appalachian Mountains, somehow connected by these little pages of art.
It gave us all hope, I think. You know, hope that we aren't just these isolated little communities struggling.
So last year, the residents in Madrid were inspired to start their own project, and they sent similar letters to another small town in New Mexico. So far, Gail says, they haven't heard back. But Seth says that some of the people in Madrid actually decided to just write back to the people in Thomas.
One of the coolest stories was that one of the kids around here, she sent a little piece of her art, and it landed in the mailbox of an artist who lived out there. And the lady replied to her and kind of critiqued her art and told her what she liked about it. And that prompted the girl who lived here to send her another piece of art. And they're still exchanging letters to this day, which is pretty cool.
The last few weeks, Seth, Audrey, and other folks in Thomas have begun another letter-writing campaign, this time for residents of a small town in West Virginia.
I don't know if I want to tell you the town, because then they'll all know that they're coming. And we kind of like it to be a surprise.
So for now, we'll leave it a mystery for you to ponder. But I will say this. all you cynics out there, watch out. A stranger could disarm all of your objections to Valentine's Day with a singular, unexpected love letter, reminding you that someone out there, someone who doesn't even know your name, sends their love. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd in Thomas. Now, another unexpected love, winter. Not everyone's cut out for the deep freeze. Former Allegheny Front intern Charlene Ward counted herself as one such person. That is until an unexpected winter camping trip she had to attend as part of a student environmental group. She's a student at Penn State now, but back then she was still in high school. Here's her account of how winter and nature won her over, at least a little.
Before I joined the Student Conservation Association, I hated winter, hated being wet from the snow. When I found out that the Conservation Leadership Corps, a community division of the SCA, had its first trip in January 2011, I prepared for a long, painful experience. It was my first SCA trip ever, so I couldn't refuse to go. Instead, I went to Kmart and bought the heaviest, most insulated boots I could, and I packed a duffel bag full of clothes just in case I got wet. And I was still petrified. Apparently, this is pretty common. On a more recent trip, Wesley Smith said,
I keep hearing from people that it's not as bad as people would think, but in my mind, I'm still telling myself it's still a big thing, and I would need like a bunch of equipment.
At least 7 inches of snow fell on our first winter retreat. Luckily, we were staying in a cabin that time. Inside, it was cozy, and we could hear the wind whipping against the chimes. But since SCA is a conservation organization, we couldn't stay inside. Our crew leaders dragged us outside almost the entire day. At first, I was miserable. Then I just looked around. I never realized how amazing the woods looked when completely covered in snow, or how remarkably peaceful it was just to sit by a frozen lake. The beauty made being cold so much more bearable. The crew spent much of the day hiking, snowball fighting, playing games, and setting up the campfire. I was having such a good time that I forgot how cold I was. The best part about the trip, and most of my winter trips, was the night hike. I recorded a group that went out in January. As the trudging through the snow started, what most were thinking about was returning to camp. You can hear our crew leader, Katie Horowitz, setting us straight.
Right now we're just going on a hike. I mean, I think we're gonna start the fire right as soon as we get back.
The hike surprised me. I never thought I would find the dead silence of winter to be so relaxing. I felt alone with my thoughts. Another crew leader, Dan Malikoff, describes it like this.
What I really like about hiking in the winter is just the stillness of it. There's nothing that moves. You know, there's hardly any animals. When the wind blows, the leaves don't move. You know, and after a while, you really start to just feel very still yourself.
What was most gratifying to me about winter camping was that I spent more than 24 hours outside in the deep cold. This is an experience I can laugh about and share when I am older. Heck, I'm even doing it now. I'm thankful that I joined the Student Conservation Association every time I step outside on a cold and snowy winter day. And when I smell a fireplace or a fire pit in my urban neighborhood, it takes me back to the campfire.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. Winter doesn't always turn warm and fuzzy. All right, so what's one of the worst things about winter? The darkness? The cold? How about traveling in the cold, especially in remote, high-altitude regions? Of course, there is something oddly charming about how helpful strangers seem to appear when you need it most. Glynis Board of West Virginia Public Broadcasting had a moment like that when she went to Preston County, West Virginia.
I had to drive out to Preston County the other day. It's a haul. One I know well, but haven't made for a while. Not since I moved away from my Arthurdale home a couple years ago. Of course, the weather was bad. In Preston County, it stays winter all through winter. So I dreaded the dicey Pee County winter slippy roads. You gotta drive around tight turns, because when you pass through, you're constantly feeling for fishtails and finding them, usually as someone is passing the other way. And in those moments, everything tightens. I finally pulled into the doctor's office, and no sooner had the door open than a couple in a nearby car called out to me, "Hey, you got a flat?" Of course I do. I thank them for pointing it out. Hurry inside. On the way out, I mentioned in the waiting room that I need to find the nearest place to fill my tire with air, or try to. One man in Carhartt jacket and pants tells me there's a gas station just down the road, but, he says, under a raised eyebrow, you'll have to pay 50 cents. Then he gets up, starts walking towards the door, saying, I have a pump in my car. Of course you do. This is Preston County, where the unofficial motto is, we've been stuck before. I followed this guy out, and he proceeds to try to put air in my tire, pointing to all the telltale nicks and creases that indicate that the tire isn't likely to hold any pressure at all. It's cold. Even my 2-year-old mentions it. Then this guy says, it's supposed to drop to negative 12 in Terra Alta tonight. I guess if you live out there, you gotta expect that, I replied. Then he said something that stuck with me and woke me up in the middle of the night to record the memory. He said, you know, though, it seems like I'm never warmer than when I'm in Terra Alta. That took me aback a little, kind of poetic. His words resonated with me. I guess they resonated with him too, because he repeated himself. Yeah, it might be cold everywhere, but it seems like I'm always warm in Terra Alta. Meanwhile, the tire stayed flat. The man advised me to take it up to the Walmart, warned me not to be taken advantage of by so-and-so, who would try to point out every problem your car had and charge too much to fix it. Then I was on my way. Slowly. Next thing, Walmart waiting tire room. And several friendly faces reassuring me that it would all work out. I believed them. Reluctantly. An hour and $7.50 later, after a series of altogether pleasant conversations and a show and tell of how impressively ruined my tire was, I was on my way. It was getting late and it was cold, really cold. The wind picked up. The snow started blowing sideways. I'm driving on a spare tire and a prayer. Of course. I'm in Preston County. This was so typical. But coming up over the hills, the sky appeared. And it looked like a Japanese painting. I could see some planet gleaming low on the horizon, like a diamond in the sky. The gusty blue and gray and white scene was so pretty. And, you know, I just felt so warm. Of course I did. I love Preston County.
We'll be right back with a love letter to a horse. This is Inside Appalachia. The show is also available as a podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and wvpublic.org.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs, to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Next, here's an audio love letter to a horse, a retired racehorse who's sometimes referred to as the Queen of Racing. Storyteller Julie Shapiro recounts the incredible racing history of the charismatic, record-breaking mare named Zenyatta.
Dear Z, it's late, but I've had it on my mind to write to you for weeks, and with the snow falling steadily outside, Nathaniel at band practice for another hour, it's the perfect time to start a letter. I still remember the exact moment I met you, about 15 months ago, when an email from my dear mother-in-law popped into my inbox with a link to a news article she thought I'd find interesting. Given my textbook horse girl identity growing up, including those 12 years spent competing at shows across the country almost every weekend, rain or shine, people forward me horsey stuff all the time. I don't usually dig into those links because I've mostly put the horse world behind me. I've moved on in my life, mostly. So who knows what compelled me to read that article, having ignored so many others? What I do know is that I was immediately hooked, call it love at first sight, and spent the hours afterward clicking on links, reading more articles, and watching videos all about you, including that unbelievable one.
Zenyatta coming flying on the grandstand side. Gio Conti on the inside. Summer Bird is right there. This is unbelievable! Zenyatta! Yata! What a performance! One we'll never forget. Looked impossible.
So you first showed up on my radar that night, but by that time, you were already a proven champ. 14 races entered, 14 wins. Zenyatta, you were unbeatable. I kept reading and learned about your past, how you were born all legs in Kentucky, a big brown filly with a white blaze on your face and two white socks on your back legs. How as a yearling, you were bought for a pittance, well, by industry standards, by the founder of a major rock and roll label. How he named you Zenyatta after a song by one of the bands in his stable and moved you out to California. And how you didn't even start racing until way into your third year. I guess that's a pretty late start for a racehorse, but you definitely made up for lost time, usually with your good friend Mike Smith in the saddle, decked out in those sassy pink and teal silks. At 17.2 hands, you were way taller than most of the boys you kept beating, bigger than most horses that ever stepped foot on a racetrack. But above all, it was your incredible personality that set you apart from the others. You were gentle and playful and loved posing for the camera. And then there was that dancing thing you did on your way to the starting gate every single time.
Zenyatta, look what she's doing with her front right there, Randy. This is patented Zenyatta, and we'll talk about this a little later on, these dance moves that she goes through.
Plus, you had that funny habit of breaking out of the gate last in every race.
Zenyatta, a little slow to get going.
And the bad start has Zenyatta at the back of the pack.
Zenyatta is dead last. Zenyatta's dead last early.
And staying back there until it seemed simply not possible for you to get to the finish line first.
Zenyatta is still last, got to be a good 12 off this lead.
Except that you always managed to get there first. And man, did those announcers lose it when you did.
And Zenyatta just making it look all too easy. This is simply poetry in motion.
How do you describe perfection? Why try? Let's just watch her run. This is Zenyatta.
Zenyatta's kicked into gear, and here she comes, right on by. Zenyatta suddenly two in front. Here's the real Zen Master, and she's 1-11.
Just another perfect day for the queen, Zenyatta!
Zenyatta, you just kept racing and winning. I know because I started following your every move, your every race, your every Facebook post, along with your legions of fans around the world. So I remember when you got voted the second best female athlete of 2009 by the Associated Press, runner-up to Serena Williams. Not bad. And when that video of you drinking a Guinness out of a Tupperware container was making the rounds.
Zenyatta enjoying her Guinness this morning after a nice little gallop.
In March 2010, you won your 15th race, and a few months later, your 16th. And then in June, I watched your 17th race from a hotel in Dublin. It was a balmy afternoon in California where you were running, and a cold and rainy early morning in Ireland where I was glued to my laptop. And I pretty much screamed at the top of my lungs along with the announcer as you zoomed up from last place to win the race.
Continues her legend, 17 in a row!
I did apologize for the noise at the front desk the next morning, but I think by then I'd crossed a line. Case in point, one night a few weeks later, I came home a little tipsy from a show and bought a $43 t-shirt with a crappy iron-on illustration of you. And it's true, all I really wanted for my birthday was a plastic briar model of you, which I was lucky to even get because those sold out fast. In August, you won your 18th straight race, and then in early October, your 19th. At this point, you'd broken so many records. Dubbed the Queen of Racing, you'd become a superheroine to people all over the world. Even 60 Minutes caught the Zenyatta bug.
Next Saturday, she could become the first great American athlete to retire undefeated in more than half a century.
Then, last November, you flew east to Kentucky to run in the 2010 Breeders' Cup Classic against a daunting field of 11 other horses, all boys. This was to be your last race ever and could extend your record to an unbelievable 20 straight wins. There was so much at stake, so much pressure from all the experts and pundits and racing know-it-alls.
The stakes are extremely high, and not just in millions of dollars.
I was really nervous for you in the days leading up to that race.
Zenyatta is so adored by horse lovers that if she doesn't beat the boys and win one last time, hearts will be broken everywhere.
The story will continue in a moment.
I wanted to watch the Breeders' Cup in real time, but found myself at a good friend's wedding in downtown Chicago right at post time.
The roar from the Churchill Downs, proud as the field is sent on their way, and Zenyatta is dead last.
I tried my best to pay attention to the ceremony, but was all too aware that you were galloping as fast as you could right around the time the children's choir was shouting its way through Bicycle Built for Two, with the bride's name switched in for Daisy.
Second, Fly Down was third, and Looking at Lucky finished fourth. Well, there we have it. Ahead will separate.
After the ceremony, while hors d'oeuvres were passed and champagne was poured, I checked my phone, discreetly, of course. And this was how I discovered that you'd lost, as they say, by a nose to blame. Everyone said you ran like a champion, but I actually could not bring myself to watch that race until I sat down to write this letter. Even 2.5 months later, knowing the outcome, it still made me cry. So, Zenyatta, you finished your career with a still-dazzling 19-1 record. And there's no doubt you've left your mark on the history of horse racing, which I'll probably go back to not paying much attention to. But I will continue to follow what you're up to. A quick check-in at Zenyatta.com confirms that you're now happily retired back in Kentucky at Lane's End Farm. I imagine it won't be long before they start breeding you. People can't wait to see your babies. And I like picturing you there, grazing in an enormous green pasture surrounded by pristine white fencing, your sides heavy with foal. Maybe you're thinking back fondly on some of your most exciting victories and the roar of the crowd. Or maybe that "So Bad It's Almost Good" country song written about you is stuck in your head. And Lexington's not that far away, perfect road trip distance, in fact. Maybe I'll find my way down there soon, with an armful of carrots and a six-pack of Guinness. Your friend, Julie.
Zenyatta arrives, you feel the crowd swell. Zenyatta, Zenyatta, you hear the crowd yell. Zenyatta, Zenyatta, hear everyone say.
That story by Julie Shapiro originally aired in the podcast Resound No. 138, The Running Show. Shapiro wrote that essay shortly after Zenyatta retired from horse racing in 2010. Zenyatta now lives on a farm in Versailles, Kentucky. In the last few years, she's given birth to 3 foals. We'll have more love letters related to our region later in the show. Right now, it's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. All right, Buttercup, it's time to pucker up again. So, around Christmas time, we explored Mistletoe, Kentucky. Where will we go for Valentine's Day weekend? This week, we go to Tennessee to another town where you might take your sweetheart for a kiss. Find out the town after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. This week, we're stepping outside of Appalachia just a little bit to Sweet Lips, Tennessee. Did it get its name for a hot little number at a kissing booth? Well, to help us this week, we hear from lifetime area resident Nancy Canada, the Chester County Public Library Director. Thanks so much for helping us out with this week's What's in a Name segment. We just had to find out where Sweet Lips, Tennessee got its name. So what story did you hear growing up?
Okay, of course, Sweet Lips is in the middle of a rural area in the middle of a very rural county. And the story that I always heard was that a traveler was passing through and, of course, on foot, and he needed water, and the water that he was given, he said, "This tastes so sweet to my lip." And there is a book that we have in our local library called Passing Gas, and it's about different small towns in America that are very oddly named, and Sweet Lips is in there, and they quote Mr. J.C. Pickett, who ran the Sweet Lips store for years and years, and he said that during the Civil War, there were soldiers that came through, and they were mapping and surveying the area, and they were very thirsty, and they drank out of a stream, and they said, "This tastes so sweet to my lips." So the that area on their maps was known as became known as Sweet Lips, and it's still that to this day.
Well, now you know how Sweet Lips, Tennessee got its name. If you have another story about Sweet Lips or know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag What's in a Name. Okay, so we just heard about Sweet Lips. How about Sweet Beaks? Humans, of course, aren't the only animals who have long-term monogamous relationships. Eagles do, too. Roxy Todd visited the Three Rivers Avian Center this week. Surrounded by rehabilitating raptors, she learned about a couple of married eagles who made the New River Gorge their home. This is a story about love, tragedy, and new beginnings.
In Summers County, West Virginia, there's a refuge and rehabilitation center for injured eagles, falcons, hawks, owls, and songbirds. Ron and Wendy Peroni have been directing the Avian Center for 24 years. That's just about as long as the 28 years that they've been married. Ron says humans aren't the only ones who form powerful long-term bonds with their mates.
We've heard of red tails, hawks, caring for a mate that's been on the ground for years, leading them to food, leading them to water, and defending them. You know, they're amazing that way.
Ron and Wendy work as a team, and together they've helped rescue almost 4,000 birds. In fact, while I was at the Avian Center, a man called and asked if they could come help a red-tailed hawk that he'd found. So I went along with Wendy and Ron on a rescue mission to the nearby town of Pax, and there we met Ira Turner and this hawk.
I found a big hawk back in the mountains. He's hurt or sick. I don't know what it is, so I thought I'd give y'all a call so y'all could come get him. Take care of him.
That red-tailed hawk, by the way, it's now doing much better. It had some big bruises near its wing where it might have been hit by a car. But despite all of this tremendous work, Ron and Wendy aren't able to save every raptor they see. Last year, a 9-year-old female bald eagle named Streaky was killed after she crashed into an Amtrak train. Her mate Whitey was killed when he flew into the same train in 2013. For years, the pair had nested and raised about 7 young eagles together right along the road near the Avian Center. Many people, including Ron and Wendy, had grown used to seeing them raise their young year after year.
They were very tender with each other and very caring for each other and lots of talking back and forth and back and forth. And it was just a joy to watch them.
And like some human couples, this pair of eagles had a particular routine whenever they were adding to their nest.
You know, they would go breaking twigs and branches off of trees when they were working on their nest. He would drag something in, and he'd fiddle with it and get it where he wanted, and she always would pick it up and move it. She was never satisfied with the way he arranged the furniture in the nest.
And unlike many smaller birds, male raptors and eagles even share some of the responsibility of raising the young.
You know, they can play with each other. They get up in the air. And when they get their young up there and they have to teach them to catch stuff, it's a game. One will have something and then they'll throw it to the other one and see if the other one can catch it out of the air.
Last year, after Streaky the bald eagle hit the same train that had killed her mate, she returned to their nest for 9 days, trying to recoup. But when she went out for food, she ran straight into a truck. Wendy and Ron found Streaky and brought her to their refuge. They tested her for lead poisoning, which causes brain damage and disorientation in many birds of prey.
She came in contaminated with lead, which we kind of expected. You know, they come in because they've been hit by a car, right? You test them for lead and they're positive and they've got a good load of it. Well, they probably were flying drunk, basically.
Lead poisoning, which very well could be the reason Streaky and Whitey both had their accidents, comes from eating fish and other meat that's contaminated. But if Wendy and Ron can catch the lead poisoning in time, they usually have a lot of success cleaning it out of a raptor system. They did get Streaky's lead levels down, but her injuries were just too extensive, and she died at their refuge. But Wendy says that a new pair of bald eagles have taken up house in Whitey and Streaky's old nest. They decided to name these eagles Brooks and Sandy.
They're hanging out there. They're adding to the nest. There's lots of mating going on and lots of loving back and forth. So we have hopes for chicks in the nest this year.
In the New River Gorge, the bald eagle population is growing. This January, 56 bald eagles were counted here. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd in Summers County.
You can see photos of the eagles from this story and other raptors at the New Rivers Avian Center on our website, wvpublic.org. This is Inside Appalachia. And now we've got another story about two young musicians who fell in love with an old style of ballad singing and storytelling and formed a lasting friendship around that music. Elizabeth Laprelle and Anna Roberts-Gavalt became friends when Laprelle's car broke down in the town where Roberts-Gavalt lived. They shared songs and harmonized, and then came Robert Gavalt's Crankies, cloth and cut paper scrolls depicting scenes from ballads. Reporter Laura Candler of WUNC produced this next story about the two's music and their love for folk music.
Working from sun to sun, spend my money when the work is done.
My name is Anna Roberts Gavalt. I'm 25 years old. I live in Blacksburg, Virginia, and I am a fiddler, banjo player, and a storyteller.
I'm Elizabeth Laprelle. I'm 25, and I sing ballads.
I was producing this project, this compilation album of all young old-time musicians. And we had heard of Elizabeth.
You friended me on Facebook.
And it turned out we were both in town that night and there was a concert. So she came out to the show. We met. Then her car wouldn't start. There's something wrong with the ignition.
Yeah, the ignition eventually, well, it had to be replaced, and that took like 24 hours. And she said, oh, you could please come stay at my house. That's right. Where the band is staying from tonight. And so I went to her house, and we spent 24 hours like singing shape note songs. And she showed me this amazing thing that she had made in college called
a cranky. A cranky is an illustrated scroll, and the illustrations, some of them are on these long quilted strips of canvas, and some of them are on these long rolls of parchment paper. And then you take the scroll and the illustrations and you put it in this frame, and which allows you this box, so as you tell the story or as you sing the ballad, you can slowly crank the scroll so you see one little piece of the scroll at a time. And so I showed Elizabeth, and she freaked out.
The way I really
kind of
out.
The same way that I'd freaked out about her singing. So that was the first 24 hours we spent together.
I'm not in your town to stay, said a lady old and gray to a warden in a penitentiary. I'm not in town to stay, and I'll soon be on my way. I'm just here to get my baby out of jail. Orden, I'm just here.
Ballads are, they're all story songs, and a lot of ballad singers, they talk about being able to see the ballad happen in their mind. You know, I'm sure it depends on your imagination, but I see all the characters and I costume them, and there's, you know, there's a setting with its own quality of light, and I, you know, imagine these places and these people and events. And so I had been really interested in kind of telling people about how visual these stories are, first we do a lot of sketching, no matter what the cranky is, and then we make a small little storyboard of a long piece of tiny paper that's just a couple inches high, and sketch on that, and then we dump out everything and
do a
few days of just cutting out all the pieces and like pinning them down and arranging them, and then we go off to sew them on separately on our own sewing machines. I guess it takes a couple of months.
We really had like no foresight beyond the next couple of months. We were like, we're going to make these crankies and we're going to do this tour just in Southwest Virginia, which is what we did. But somehow word got out and we got these offers or people who are interested around the, America.
When I was a young girl, I used to seek pleasure. When I was a young girl, I used to drink ale out of an alehouse and into the
did our first show in a bar. We were at this bar in Richmond and we sang an a cappella song. I think it might have been Heap of Horses. And all of a sudden, the whole room was quiet. And then we got everyone to sit on the floor cross-legged to watch our crankies. It's a Heap of Horses is a lullaby that Texas Gladden sang. And it's kind of the epitome of a lot of what we're trying to share with our shows, which is this idea that, music having a use, functional music. We don't have work songs anymore, per se, for working on a computer. But lullabies are still there.
Go to sleep, you little baby. When you wake, get some cake and ride them pretty little horses. A black and a bay, a sorrel and a gray. A whole heap of little horses, a black and a bay, a sorrel and a gray, a whole heap of little horses.
I'd say overall people, well, especially during crankies, adults turn into children, which is beautiful to watch from stage, just all these big eyes looking at this cranky that you're scrolling. That's probably my favorite reaction.
I think my favorite is when people come up and they're like, that was great, but I kind of really want to go home right now and make one. Because I think it brings stories to mind in the minds of other people, which is perfect.
One of the most memorable reactions recently, we were out in Olympia, Washington, and this woman came up to me and her family was from East Kentucky. Like, her grandparents and her parents are all from East Kentucky, and they had moved out of the mountains, because there weren't any jobs, and then she moved out to the West Coast. And she was just kind of really teary and talking to me about how wonderful it was to hear about where her family's from. And, when we started mentioning Kentucky, she said, my daughter looked at me, and she was, like, really proud that her family was from Kentucky, and there was just something really fulfilling to me about being able to like bridge that for this woman, to help people remember where they're from.
You know, wherever we go, it's not that we're trying to get people to love banjos or want to learn to play them, because there's awesome heritage around it. We would rather, go somewhere and have it bring up a question in their mind of, oh, what's the heritage or where I am, whether it's through my family or whether it's through where I live, or what is the history that I can inquire into? What are the stories that are in my life?
I'm gonna cross that green icy mountain.
originally aired on WUNC in 2013. Now, Leprell and Robert Skivault have a new album that will be released on March 17th on Free Dirt Records. Robert Skivault has also since moved to Baltimore. They'll be performing a show in Lewisburg, West Virginia in late March.
I'm gonna cross that green ice and
we wrap up the show with two final love letters for Appalachia. Rance Garrison grew up in Lee County, Virginia. He's currently an AmeriCorps Vista at WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky. Here's Rance Garrison with his love letter to Appalachia.
Home by Rance Garrison. For better or for worse, through sickness and in health, for richer or poorer. Committing to a place in a community is a lot like committing to a marriage. It takes work. It takes willpower. It takes dedication. But above all else, it takes love. As a relatively newly and happily married man, I can tell you firsthand that love is the not-so-secret ingredient in any relationship. The struggles of day-to-day life, the bouts with sickness, the financial stress that most newlyweds face, it can all be conquered by love, and love is ultimately what has kept my wife and I going strong for 6 years now as a couple and for 8 months as a married couple. I have my reservations about trying to compare living in Appalachia or anywhere else for that matter to something as sacred as marriage. However, when I really break it down and examine marriage as the beginning point of many families, including my own, and when I trace my own family line back through over a century of people who lived and died in these ruggedly beautiful mountains, a line that includes farmers and prison guards and automobile mechanics and coal miners and storekeepers and mothers and fathers and husbands and wives, I can see where you could definitely draw those similarities. As I approach my 29th year on this planet, family is becoming more important to me than ever before. I've already lost most of my grandparents, and I know that I will not have the wisdom of older generations to draw on forever, and there will come a time in the near future when I will have children of my own to guide and to mold to the best of my ability. And there will also come a time, hopefully several decades down the line, when my own life will draw to a close and it will be time for me to exit the stage, hopefully with grace and dignity, having left things in my community and in my world at least a little bit better than they were when I got here, and having left something of value for generations to come. My family is here, and that's why when I think of Appalachia in general, and Southwest Virginia in particular, I can only think of home. No, this place isn't perfect. Its economic struggles have been well documented, and its spiritual ones have been as well. But you show me a perfect city. Show me a perfect community. Show me a perfect family, or a perfect marriage, or a perfect human being, and I will show you a carefully crafted facade. Perfection, at least in this realm, does not exist and never, ever will. But love does, and home is wherever love is. And for better or worse, I'm home. Till death do us part.
That was Rance Garrison, AmeriCorps Vista with WMMT. Rance also works to help organize the STAY project, Stay Together Appalachian Youth. More information is on our website, wvpublic.org. Another person working on the STAY project is Willa Johnson. She is an East Kentucky native currently working as an Appalachian Transition Fellow in North Carolina.
Appalachian love stories exist beyond people. Sometimes our love stories are between the land and us. Heaven knows staying in our communities isn't an easy path to take. For me, it's a long, twisted trail up the mountain behind my Papo Hillard's house. My path starts where the gravel ends on the hillside, and the smell of rotten apples fallen from the trees attracts bees in August. There sits a cemetery. It's small and hard to get to when your purpose is laying someone in their final resting place. I have stood here several times in my life. I remember when there was just one headstone here, one solitaire stone for a man I never knew. Then one warm October day, just past my 9th birthday, My great-granny hat took her place next to that headstone. Years have passed and more headstones have appeared. Tears have been shed many times there on that hillside, overlooking the plots of land that I spent my childhood playing hide-and-seek with cousins. The faint smell of Sunday cookouts still roams through the air, even though the practice was abandoned years ago. Laughter has been shared here, too. After all, this was prime sleigh riding land. One winter as a teenager, a surprise snowstorm had hit and we didn't have a sleigh in sight. We piled on layers of clothes and visited Papaw for trash bags from under his kitchen sink. Dollar store trash bags, a foot of snow, and us girls made memories that we draw on every winter to cheer each other up. The garden is adjacent to the cemetery. When I was little, a possum was caught in the living trap there. I wasted hours one day admiring his frozen stance in the cages as he stood on his hind feet with one hand clasping the top of the cage, staring without blinking, so still that one trickle of drool hung from his gaping mouth at the end of his tongue. Every year there's a count of how many copperheads are killed in that garden. Past the cemetery is a tree line and the mountain trail. When I was a little girl, I would walk the trails with my dad as he hunted. He would take his 12-gauge and I had my wooden toy rifle. Once we barely cleared the tree line when a bee stung me through my white bobby socks and got stuck in the material, so my dad pulled it out with his bare hands, also getting stung. We turned around and made our way back down the hillside to our house so that my mom could take care of my sting and give my dad a shot with his EpiPen. These hunting trips were pretty unfruitful in terms of killing any animals, but full of memories about how to swing from a grapevine. In my 20s, my papaw called to tell me he had hiked the mountain after hearing something in the middle of the night. He found a giant boulder there that landed not too far from a nearby mining company who had blasted the mountain. When I went with the camera to take pictures the next day, he told me he suspected it was gone. He had heard machinery working through the night. Sure enough, his property had been trespassed and the boulder was gone, but Papaw said to leave it alone. He was too old to fight about it. That mountainside was the constant in my childhood. It provided me with scenes for my imagination to run wild. Fresh water that could be piped to our house when the tank in their city water system went dry for 2 months. A place to grieve and honor family members, and a place to see growth every spring and summer when my papaw's garden began to bloom. I sometimes don't credit that mountain enough, but it was a character in my life as much as any human has been. That mountain is what keeps calling me back.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WMMT, WUNC, the Allegheny Front, NPR, and WVTF.
Music in today's show was provided by Walt Kokin, Jake Sheps, the Glenville State Bluegrass Band, Andrea Tomasi, John Wyatt, and Andy Agnew Jr. Our producer is Roxy Todd. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at @InAppalachia or at WV Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at WVPublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.